Welcome to the Real Estate Addicts Podcast. This is episode 93 with your hosts, Mark Svatsky, Choose Boston.
Ray Herto, RH Investment Group.
Dan Rubin, RH Investment Group.
And we're joined today by our guests.
Tom Collar of the Elevated Companies.
And J.D. Wild of the Elevated Companies as well.
Long overdue.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I've always wondered how you guys take turns introducing yourselves.
Yeah, it's very spontaneous.
Yeah.
Yep. Mark was pointing at me as Dan and I sat awkwardly. Who's next?
I was just looking at your mustache.
It's not going away. In fact, I've upped the ante now. I've got I've got four eyes instead of two.
It's great.
And finally see again.
Excellent. So JD, Tom, tell us about Elevated. You guys have a brokerage group, development business, now a burgeoning construction, sort of general contracting for fee. We can get into that a little bit. Lots to talk about.
We'd love to talk about it.
We're
fired. Yeah, there's two of us, so I'll try to answer this one. But we're a vertically integrated company. So, we started in the development and brokerage space and logically kind of grew into the construction arm. We were self-performing the construction, mainly myself initially. And I met Tom at a networking event and he kind of opened my eyes to what's possible as a team. And, you know, since then we've brought on other partners and grown the brands. And so now we don't really do a ton of property management other than our own inventory, but we certainly do the warranty work and self-perform that. And so we're a brokerage, development company, and a construction company. Those are our three main lines of business.
Nice. How many units and what types?
So it varies. I mean, right now we're consistently in the 6 to 9 unit range. That's really our sweet spot.
Four or five jobs at a time.
Yeah.
How many assets you have, like long-term holds or rentals?
So as a company, as Elevated, we don't own any assets. It's individual.
Just managing.
So there's three partners in the company. Tom is one, I'm one, and then Dan Duval is one. All three of us individually own separate assets. Wow. I'm in the 45 unit range myself personally. I think Dan and Tom both kind of their hometown stuff. We all own stuff in our hometowns. Really, that's the main focus.
Nice. Oh,
is that how you keep from overlapping? And like, how do you find and not, you know, say it's who you want one, right?
Like, well, if it's a good deal, draw straws. You keep that for yourself. If it's mediocre, you bring it.
It's a great question. It's actually a hard line to draw. So what we decided was anything that's in the city of Boston, we would bring to the team. Anything outside the city of Boston is kind of fair game. If you want to ask someone to partner within the office or one of the
kind of play to your own strengths.
Yeah. But if it's in the city, we do keep it within the Elevated brand.
That's cool.
That is very cool. I don't think I knew that.
Yeah.
Nice.
We'd love to be self-performing strictly our own work. We'd love to get into the GC conversation as well.
Yeah. You're starting to take on more of that type of work.
Maybe less.
GC for fee. Yeah. So you've taken a few projects to this point, finished them and.
Yeah. About half a dozen, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And how's that?
Different from building for yourself.
Definitely different from yourself.
I'll let Tom give his opinion.
It's difficult to make it work economically. It's hard to find an owner who understands what costs it takes to perform these projects. And then also you're layering on many more areas of expectation, whether, you know, the owner wants to weigh in on design or they want to weigh in on construction or budget. You're really taking on a lot of, I'll call it downside. JD has a lot of the same feelings.
Yeah, when we got into this space, we never intentionally stepped into working for owners as like a line of business that we were trying to grow. It was really to kind of scale and pay for some of the overhead as part of that scaling process. To be honest with you, the line of business and the risk associated with it isn't really worth the scaling, right? So we found that when we were that size, our overhead was more, there's more risk, there's more downside, there's more stress, more time constraints. So we'd rather be smaller and leaner at this point and just operate really efficiently. We call it a killer's only strategy, right? If you're not a killer, we're not just going to hire to scale. And as you're growing, you have to. Mm-hmm. It's really just the reality of that line of business. So it's very difficult to make good money in that space. I mean,
do you think that's a function of the size of the projects, or do you think it's
a little bit in the sense that the budgets are smaller?
Yeah.
It might also be a sense of all your other kind of pillars of the business, right? Because when you're starting to take on GC projects as a fee, it kind of takes away from your own development projects that you're also self-performing. So it's almost like you're kind you're pulling labor and you're pulling resources away or thinning those resources across unless you bring on more.
Yeah. And one of the things that we found is really tough is as the developer, right? We handle the process from A to Z. So when it comes to utilities, we're way ahead of the game because we know how important that is for us on the sales side and the delivery, right? traditionally, that's not necessarily the general contractor's issue if the general contractor is not being brought in until a stage in which the utilities have already been planned. So inherently, the GC absorbs that risk, because if the owner hasn't planned for that, you're kind of getting to a part where the project's at like a standstill, because you need those to move forward. And anything that we build, we sell. That's part of our process. So, we found that we wind up taking on more work than the GC probably should, because we want to deliver an A to Z experience and kind of see it from start to finish. And then we don't necessarily get paid for that. So we've been charging now as we've grown the business. We've developed like a pre-construction fee, and we've developed a CO fee. Like we're finding ways to recoup that cost. But even with doing that, we're just getting paid for our time. We're not making money on it.
Are you getting the listings if it's a for sale project?
Yeah. So we're only building for sale projects, and we are getting the listings.
Got it.
And so the vertical integration you referred to is, you know, you're there at conception of the project. You're building it.
Well, maybe not selling it out. Right?
Yeah. You try to be.
Or as close to it as you can. Obviously, you might be given a set of plans and say, hey, go make something happen here. But
yeah, the way I like to phrase is we try to be a development partner, right? So we're not interested in being like a competing interest, like a third party that you bring on and, hey, here's what it costs, anything over that. We want to work collaboratively, and we want to be a value-driven service provider. When we got into it, again, we were looking to scale, right? We can grow the brokerage. We can hire more people. We can pay for better infrastructure. We can learn. We can build the brand. All good things. The more you get into the business, we step back and we're like, geez, we could operate leaner, have higher profit margins, less risk, and truly focus more on the projects that we enjoy rather than doing a lot of these projects that we didn't source. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not necessarily the type of projects we want to be doing.
Makes sense. Yeah.
No, it really is a low margin business.
Yeah.
And it is high risk.
And it's capital intensive. Like, how do you manage your capital outlays between owners paying you?
The bank.
Yeah, like that's true too.
You got to wreck. Otherwise, right. You're going to be
expense. We wind up putting forward some of the money to carry the job, because right. Otherwise our guys aren't getting paid, and we're waiting for requisitions and stuff.
A lot of intangibles too, like whether it's being treated as the bank, or we like to stand behind our product, and you know that's a lot of warranty risk out there. Like where our people are returning, we're bringing our subs back. If it's in house, it's easy to control. If it's another owner, you know, people are panicky, people are pushing, and could be neighbors. Like maybe neighbors are upset with you. You're just sent there to build it. You're not the developer. Mm-hmm. But those intangibles add up. They beat on our people. They cost money.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as far as the idea of a delay due to utilities not being there when you thought they'd be there, and an owner who didn't do their part, at a certain level, you should lay a delay claim down that says, I have extended general conditions and my staff isn't free and you didn't do your job, so we're here longer. But that's a little bit more formal.
Is that from your days at Suffolk?
That's a claim that I have on both sides of.
That's a great point, though. So there's a cost associated with that, though, right? So you have to have those conversations. They steal your energy. You have to write it up. Mm-hmm. You have to stand behind it. You have to wait to collect it. Mm-hmm. In our space, we want to move fast, and we want to be in high margin space. So all of those conversations steal your energy and prevent you from going and finding new deals, growing the business.
Totally.
They're exhausting.
Like to take a quick break to thank our sponsor, First Boston Capital Partners. David Grossman is a great local lender. If you have a project that you're looking to finance, feel free to reach out to us. We can put you in touch with him. They're fast, they're flexible. They have a lot of options available, both on the debt and equity side. So any financing needs, feel free to reach out. And back to our episode.
Yeah. And the thing about going fast and having great partners is it's all good until you get blindsided. And that's when you find out if the partner is really good or not. It's, you know, they come in, they ask you to do something and it's perhaps gray, and you get called to task and you have to go and change out all the lights for a, fire rated housing. And at that point, who owns that?
So fire rated houses are my favorite example.
It's a good example.
Yeah. Especially if you're building for that. I would love to, man. Like, you always want the correct knowledge, right? So, like, you might know that can should be fire rated. You could be working with an owner who's never considered it, and you want to pay, say, $9,000 for, you know, 100 some odd fixtures. The electrician's telling you don't need to. He'll get signed off. The owner's telling you. But you're sitting there. You want to build correctly. You want to give the correct advice. You want to do your job correctly. And you're kind of stuck in, like, a knowledge gap where no one else is doing it, or the electrician says you don't have to.
So for further context, this is a multifamily development, and this is a ceiling that is bifurcating two, you know, different units. You have a fire-rated assembly.
Yeah.
And by right, you should probably be using a fire-rated housing.
I explained the problem. You wanted me to explain the light.
But I mean, in that scenario, do you just present it to the owner as here's the condition and, you know, you can sign off or I don't know if there's other paperwork where you can, you know, lay claim after the fact? I mean, you could roll the dice, or if there's a relationship at the town level, I don't know.
It's a tough one.
AHJ versus
You certainly could get a waiver. Hey, this is your liability. You're instructing me to do this, but it's still your license. And if something happens.
Yeah. In the 6 to 9 unit space where a majority of our projects are, as you guys know, like the cost is not as exorbitant as it would be. Obviously it'd be extraordinary. Mm-hmm. If you're talking a 30, 50 unit building, it's a huge change order. So we're fortunate that a lot of the times we run into those types of things where we just want to build better buildings than the plans called for. The cost differential is not enormous. So it's usually an easier conversation. So fingers crossed, we're blessed there.
That's good.
That's true, yeah.
Let's get into a little bit on warranty work, because JD, we had a good conversation at the last Build Boston networking event. I think one thing that I've gotten in the habit of doing lately is no matter what the warranty call that comes in, I get my trade partner and I just put it back. I used to really play defense for all my guys, get a call on a 110 degree day that my air conditioning won't hold 65 and start by explaining that there are design days and this is within parameters. It's just not worth it. At this point, it's just thank you for the call. Let me get my HVAC guy to come over and speak to you. Mm-hmm. Because it's thankless to try to do otherwise. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, warranty work is a pain point. You know, before COVID, we very rarely had people bring up small stuff. It was always like, hey, the AC is not working, or, I noticed a water stain on a really rainy day. So it was really manageable in the sense that you would go there, it was easy to identify what was going on. You knew they weren't being crazy, so you would go there. But since COVID, there's just been this change in the way people treat each other. And we often feel like everybody immediately jumps to kind of like the doomsday scenario. Like, oh, there was a leak on a crazy rainy day. You need to cut that open and check that there's no mold. And we're like, if you want to.
My cabinets are hitting. The building is settling.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Yeah, and they're all home. A lot of people are home staring.
There's a crack in my grout.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We had someone at one time who had a stress crack and claimed that they wanted to get a structural engineer because they thought it was because. And it was, I was like, you can do whatever you want. Realistically, when it comes to warranty, and I'll let Tom kind of weigh in on his perspective, we always say at the forefront, we stand behind our product, and there's times that someone might disagree what that statement means, but the reality is we're not going anywhere. We're not briefcase contractors who are going to just all of a sudden disappear off the scene. Like, we really do show face and we try to respond. It just is a balance, because a lot of the times the person on their side might be unreasonable, and no matter what you do, you're not going to keep them happy. And it's hard, because I know both Tom and I want to be people pleasers. We want to do things the right way. And we want people to say, you know what, at the end of the day, I wish they did it differently or it never happened, but they're good guys.
Pretty good guys, yeah.
And you don't always have control over that. No matter how honest you are, no matter how often you show up, no matter how good of a person you are, there's times that, 6 stress cracks might make them think that you built the building wrong.
I think the point you're making applies across so many industries, and it's just folks shitting on other people, whether it's in retail or anything services related. It's just been one horror show after another of people just out of control. And so maybe there's a balance or a way to keep people from freaking out about little things, or I don't know. I don't know why people seem so on edge about a lot of things. Is it something they see on the internet? Is it just they don't know any better? It's crazy.
It's like a breakdown in society.
Yeah, it's a huge difference. I mean, we've seen a drastic change in the. We used to do, 8-9 unit buildings before COVID, and we, over the 1-year warranty, maybe we'd get, 10 across all 9 units. And now we'll get 10 from one unit.
It's like prior to doing your blue tape walkthrough, I feel like you should have to wear a pouch and spend like at least 48 hours on a job site actually trying to put work in place and see how difficult it is not to nick something ever so slightly or fix a very minor imperfection. Like, people have become so accustomed to the lights turning on when they hit the switch and the toilet flushing that they've forgotten all the effort that goes into it.
100%.
There's just no appreciation. It's just,
It's difficult too for the builder, because you're knee deep in the projects. You're staring at these things all day long. So someone could walk in and be like, how did no one notice this defect? And like, well, literally here all day, every day, looking at way more complex problems. Like, that, truthfully, the eye just misses it.
Oh, no, I was going to say, you ever have like a walkthrough prior to closing and they're like, it's the blue tape of death. It's like, just paint the wall. Just repaint the wall.
Totally.
Yeah,
it's that kind of like level of psychosis.
The sun hits the wall just perfectly that day. And you're like, oh, dude.
I try to set expectations, but that can backfire too. Because sometimes they're perfectly rational. And like you, by setting this up, are not doing yourself a favor, but arm's length away under normal lighting conditions. Do not take out your iPhone flashlight and put your nose against the wall. That's not the standard.
Is this a level 4 finish? Yeah. What are we doing here?
People working from home too. They're like, you know, at 312 when the light reflects off the Trex. Like,
maybe that's it too.
Yeah.
There's so many more people just sitting in their houses all day, just staring.
So I will say that is absolutely one of the biggest points that we've seen is people used to not want to have to take time off from work to go meet someone to, you know, crown molding separate a little bit, caulk and paint it. No one was like, I don't care that much. And now I think the person's sitting at home in their office and they're like, oh, come by whenever, I'm here.
Yeah.
not only are they reaching out more because they can and they're sitting at a computer all day long at home, but I also think that a part of it is like they're expecting it in a more timely manner. So before it was like, well, I'm busy, you're busy, you let me know what dates work for you and I'll let you know what dates work for me. Now it's like, you haven't come in 24 hours for the stress crack. And it's like, well, I'm going to wait until you give me a list that is actual substance. Yeah. And then we're going to mobilize and we're going to spend a day there chipping away at the whole list.
Yeah. You know, and then this brings up an interesting follow-up question, which is like, how do you separate yourself from this? So, you know, we were chatting, you go to tuck your kids in at night, you go to dinner with your wife and you just got a call from somebody who's maybe disrespectful, not understanding, and you're trying to be a people pleaser and you're trying to do a good job. And it's so hard to kind of flip that switch.
Yeah, we talk about this all the time. I think that like your mind is like that's what we're trying to work on the most. Keep yourselves above that and beyond that. Cause if you do bring home, like you could just be miserable all the time. So just continually growing in that regard. And then, you know, telling yourself, like when you do find that line, if we like replace someone's entire floor and they're still not happy at the end of the day and, you know, now they have a new complaint, you just got to be honest with yourself that you're maybe not making that person happy.
You've gone above and beyond already.
Mm-hmm. Tom and I spend a majority of our days like connecting on the phone, seeing how jobs are going. And it's often stress management. It's how do you manage the workflow and still be present at home? Because both Tom and I have young kids and I think it's very hard. And I think it's sometimes hard for our wives to understand that like when you get home, you can't just like hit the switch and all of a sudden you're in daddy mode and there's nothing else on your mind. The kids will certainly bring joy to you and like remind you. It'll give you perspective. It'll make you realize how little those problems you had during the day really are oftentimes. But it doesn't mean that just instantly all the stress is gone. And, you know, I put away my phone when I get home, but make no mistake, as soon as I put the kids down, I'm running for my phone to see how many tech, you know, because it just adds up and then you're back in that mode. So
perspective is a great point. Like, you know, you used to be bothered by someone trying to call you 3 or 4 times or something unimportant, but like if you have 2-3 kids running around, you're like, I don't need to be bothered by that person.
Yeah. It's hard. It is hard. Like, you know, my phone starts ringing at like 6:45 in the morning. Like, we're here. Like, where's this delivery going? Like, what's the gate code? Like, just general stuff. And
the gate code's the same one I told you.
It hasn't changed for the last 9 months.
It's also in your text.
The way I say it is I wake up to a fire hose of problems. And as soon as I go to bed, the fire hose turns off and I wake up the next day and the fire hose turns back on. But
it's always on.
It's better than being broke, you know? So that's what it takes. So
one of the reasons why we moved to more of the apartment type buildings and away from the for sale development was main like warranty stuff is it's a lot. It can eat at you and it can take away from stuff that you already have going on or stuff that you're now fully invested in. So, you know, that's one of the small main reasons. Yeah. Small main reason.
Yeah. One of the statements I'd made to Mark when we caught up on this was Tom and I are both very competent. Like we both kind of grew in the space by self-performing, doing a lot of stuff ourselves. So we kind of screwed things up on our own homes and on our own projects to like really learn the path. At this stage, we can walk into a building on a warranty and pretty quickly be like, okay, this is what we're going to have to do. I wish it was a shortcut, but realistically, you got to do this. And we look at it with that lens and we think we're pretty productive and efficient in how we address those things. I often worry, maybe worry is not the right, but I often wonder how other people are managing this because I see a lot of solo operators out there that are doing a couple of projects a year.
Spitting units out.
And it's hard for us at the scale we are to keep people happy and get out there and do it. Like, I wonder if those people are even satisfying them at all, or if they're just, you know, it's hard.
We actually had an awesome employee that was a referral of Mark's that we love. And his number one thing on exit was that, like, just talking to people who are negative all the time, responding to these warranty calls and having to, you know, speak with them and work through things with them was not something he wanted to do every day. You can understand it.
I've talked to some buyers that say that they've had issues, and when the builder sells them the building, they're gone and they never hear from them again. And that's,
we think there's probably a lot of people like that.
A lot of people.
So my argument would be, why don't they distinguish that versus, so you have a scenario in which you have a builder who just disappears and doesn't respond. And then you have a builder who, say they show up and they keep chipping away at the list, but it's not done on the timeline that you want, or it's not done how you want it done, but at least they're responding and showing up. They don't separate the two. No. Like, I feel like they both get treated the same.
In fact, sometimes you'll probably get treated. The person that actually shows up gets treated worse.
It's like the Boston zoning process. The guy that goes in there as a nice guy and tries to do things the right way and engage the community does not get treated differently than the person who just goes forward with the same project with their attorney and does not listen to the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a pain point. I wish, and I know a lot of the home buyers probably are not listening to this podcast, but I wish they would understand that we do care. You know, we are trying, and we're trying to build better buildings. Like, there's not a day that goes by that Tom and I aren't trying to get 1% better in our trade and in our field. And, you know, we're genuinely responsive and we try to be good human beings, and we're not going anywhere. So,
and to be clear, there's buyers who I would take a bullet for. I will show up 10 years later and help them with it, with whatever it wants to be. But there are just other people that at day 366 lose my number. And it's the same with being a landlord too. Like, I have some great tenants who I'll write them letters, I'll help them any way I can help them. But like, others just want to torture you. And it's like, this is a two-way street. This is more a general, not construction specific, but life thing. But man, it's amazing how short-sighted people can be.
Absolutely, yeah.
So where do you see yourselves moving towards? Because, you know, you've been doing kind of like the 6 to 9, you've been in the 6 to 9 unit space for a while now.
Yeah.
So kind of where do you see the business shifting to or growing to over the next 5-10 years?
So, I mean, I'll let Tom weigh in on his opinion. I think for me, and Tom and I talk a lot about this, is we want to be focused on quality over quantity. Again, we played that big bull run there we had. We were doing 4 to 6 projects a year completion and 4 to 6 under construction. And so anywhere from 6 to 10 projects a year. And, you know, we really want to shift back to a more qualitative approach where people are going to reward us and pay more money for a better product and a better brand and a better process. Whether that's, you know, a 9-unit boutique building that's super high-end finishes that kind of breaks record prices, but people pay for the quality and they see kind of the thoughtfulness and the design and the floor plan, or that's a 20-unit building with, you know, just strong price points, good floor plans, and kind of functional flow of the building. We're certainly not going backwards. Like, we're really kind of out of that 3-family. It's not worth the work. I don't think the 6-unit or the 9-unit is that much more work than the 3-family.
No, and I also won't do a project where it's like, take a kitchen and make it a nicer kitchen.
Yeah, no.
Take that bathroom, make it nicer, and now try to sell it. It's just, there's no money in that. If it's add on to the rear, pop top, add a floor, dig out the basement, sure, I'm all in. But absent that, I'm not going to touch it.
Yeah. Not the fluff and buff.
No.
How much of a location do you think plays into that investment thesis going forward? Like, you know, you could have the nicest house, but in a shit location, you could break records, I guess, right? But your cost of labor and materials will be relatively the same versus a, you know, more not shitty area, I guess. you know what I'm trying to say.
We've intentionally taken on some prominent location jobs before because we want to kind of fly that we call flying the banner. Yeah. We want to be like at the forefront. The same profit on 2 deals might not be the same net profit, right? The reality is that some of these sites are really tough. Some of them, one we did recently, there was like a utility upgrade at the intersection of our job. It was a very prominent intersection.
Totally unforeseen.
And the city just showed up one day with probably $10-15 million in equipment, parked themselves on the corner, took every single parking spot and said, oh, we're here to do a utility upgrade. We're like, all right, how long is it going to take? 4 to 6 weeks. 4 months later, they're still there taking up the entire intersection. No one can park of our trades. Everyone wants to charge us change orders because they're like, we can't even perform our scope.
Rescinded our crane permits. We're in the middle of erecting steel. They took away all week.
Took away all our permits.
Oh my God. That's a nightmare.
Made us work on Saturdays. So we had to pay a change order every Saturday, pay all these over
premium time to everybody.
These are the types of unknown unknowns, right? Like I sign up for a certain amount of risk. The market changes, interest rates go up. Mm-hmm. Like, sure, I can anticipate that. But when National Grid goes on strike for a year and a half.
About the Sumner Tunnel, they're saying no utility permits.
No utility. Yeah, that's another one. That's it.
So here's an unknown.
Wait, no utility permits?
Yes.
In East Boston.
So
just because of the tunnel shutdown?
They're not issuing any utility. So National Grid says, hey, we want the building weather tight. So we say, hey, we're weather tight. And they say, no. Your storefront windows aren't in yet. The first floor is not weather tight. We're like, the commercial storefront, they're going at the end of the project. We're not going to put these massive glass panes in. And they're like, nope. So we spend the money, we zip it ourselves, we close it all off. So now we have no light on the first floor. Get it done. 3 weeks later, we send them pictures and we say, hey, just want to let you know it's weather tight now. And they say, oh, sorry, we're not issuing permits till the end of the summer. Do the Sumner Tunnel being closed. We're like, oh, that's great.
And then everybody's going to be rushing in at the end of the summer. Yeah. And then the winter moratorium is going to show up on November 15th.
Yeah.
There's no room. Oh,
man.
Yeah. You literally have 2.5 months to get everything done before the winter moratorium. Because Sumner Tunnel opens up after Labor
Day. I should hope that they would have some sort of grace during the winter moratorium for that.
You can still get your utilities under moratorium. You just have to have a...
It's much harder.
Oh, they made it worse.
It's also weather permitted. So we say that because we've been going through mild winters for the past couple of years. You get a bad winter. They're not issuing those.
It's going to be a bad winter. Yeah. I'm gonna put that bet out
there. So to our listeners, I think...
El Nino is back, baby.
Yeah, typically there is a moratorium on any street opening starting
in
the city of Boston around November 15th.
To April.
Yeah. And you need to apply specifically for an exemption. And it's become increasingly difficult.
It's funny you say all these because Dan and I have had discussions recently just kind of scratching our heads. Like, what is the allure of the urban development? Like, I get it. You're close to everything. But what's the antithesis of that just going outside and having a bigger site to work on and more access and surface parking spaces and things that other tenants
define urban? Because Boston's urban, right? But there's still a lot of urban development going around the city.
Yeah, even what we're doing in Lynn, it's their central business district. I'm talking about getting out of an area where the site is logistically challenging. I guess that doesn't really play into the utility side of things, but...
Well, it's because it's where the market is.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we kind of excel at it too, to piggyback off what JD was saying. The game is difficult, so not a lot of people are figuring it out at speed. And we like to think we do, and more we're approached with more challenging projects. And we do enjoy them, and we do enjoy figuring them out. But to your point, where we'd like to get is where, you know, we're being rewarded for that, not talking to someone who's, doesn't think it's worth more money or having an agent ask for an asking price that makes construction almost unfeasible.
Yeah.
We do enjoy playing in that space.
It's a high barrier to entry.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I guess my point is, you know, you'll look at other developments that are happening in some of these secondary, tertiary markets. And maybe they're part of a PUD or something, you know, larger, but dense multi-unit development seems to be okay. Or even like a giant subdivision, right? Those seem to be safe bets. You're going to have buyers or renters or both. I get the allure of the urban side, but I'm wondering why not play in a different space? Not you directly, just in general.
Sure.
We all gravitate. I mean, like, why are we swimming upstream fighting all these things that make life difficult?
Yeah. So we're doing two custom homes right now in Milton, two house subdivision on a 4-acre lot. And, it was kind of our push towards getting outside the city.
Single families,
two large single families. And, but you know, you run into constraints there. We found concrete buried, no trash, which is a blessing, no ledge, which is a blessing, but
4 highways worth of concrete.
Yeah. A lot of concrete was buried to build up the grade back in the day. And, you run into constraints there too. I will say that there's something nice about, you know, sitting outside, being on the water on a piece of land on a job, as opposed to being in a city that's cars are honking their horns and swerving by you and you're moving traffic barriers just so that people can get by. Like, there is pros and cons to it.
Those constraints cost money too. Yeah. So you do have to ensure that the market's there.
And that's a space that I don't think Tom or I ever intended to really be in, but I think it's a space where quality gets rewarded. So it's certainly somewhere we're looking because we want to be rewarded for quality.
My canned answer on single family development is always that I find it to be very risky. You know, if I finish a 6-unit building and the market has turned, interest rates have gone up, I can rent that and cover my nut. Build a $2.5 million single family, $3 million, and it doesn't sell, and you're paying the mortgage on that. No rent is going to cover your note. You're in trouble.
The only qualifier I would say there is that I think there's certain towns where there's very low risk on the, it's no longer speculative. Like, yeah, not enough housing inventory, and there is plenty of money to be spent. They will pay for quality. They will pay for it. But there's certainly, like I would never go to towns that we don't know a lot about that are kind of outside.
I hear you on that, like Brookline, Wellesley.
Milton's a good example. Like, there's just not enough housing inventory in Milton. And I've seen houses sell for, even in this little bit downward press market, for way more than they should because of the lack of inventory. And it was a high-end quality product.
I see this more in like a place in Florida where you go there for vacation, you go the next year and the same for sale sign is still up on the same spec house. And you're just like, whoa.
Or you're driving to the new development and passing the development from 10 years ago and it's empty.
Yeah.
Or you see like a 16 house subdivision in Hanover and you're like, it's great that Hanover has had a great run because everyone's had a great run. But at some point that music's going to stop.
Right.
And those price points aren't going to be achievable and the cost of construction is still going to be as high and you're going to have paid what you paid for the acquisition.
Yeah. Be interesting to see with interest rates going up what happens to the for sale market. I feel like so far it's been pretty much immune. The market's just kind of adjusted and kept going.
At least here. I mean, real estate obviously is local. Other markets have definitely had problems. Austin, Phoenix, San Francisco for different reasons. I would say that once rates start going down, now you're going to have more people trying to jump in. And we haven't had any supply come on because nobody's incentivized to sell unless they absolutely need to. They don't want to jump from a sub-4 interest rate to a near 7. It makes no sense.
Yeah, we get asked that question all the time, being in the brokerage business, like, you know, what do you see in the market? And it's incredibly tough because I can't really wrap my head around how we come out of this and go on another bull run and it just rips from here. Like, to me, I think there's a general consensus that, oh, you think the market's, you know, moving now, wait till rates drop. But to me, I'm like, I don't think there's enough income to justify home prices going up from here. Like, I don't see where the affordability component comes into place, right? If things go up from here, wages have to go up from there, which means we're back in an inflationary environment. And we're right back to where we were before. For me, it doesn't add up. So I also don't know the answer, you know?
It's tricky. Yeah. It's tough. We're in a very weird gray area right now where demand is still there. And supply is really low, but rates are high. So
The other factor, macro factor that can't be overlooked is the generational wealth transfer that is happening today, tomorrow, the next few years. It's you know, people likely our parents' age who are starting to are sitting on enormous wealth in their homes, and they're getting older. And I've seen that with a number of my buyers where down payments come with letters and offers. So I think that's real.
You wonder how much of that, if it's going to be any higher a percentage of the total sales or percentage of, we'll call it, people passing away and things passing on to the next generation. Is that going to be a higher percentage just kept and held and never entering that inventory? So you have to build something new because it may never get replaced. It may stay generational, multi-generational. Let's dive into something else. Since you guys are talking about all these quality items, where are you seeing yourselves with finishes? Like, are you kind of hearing buyers say they're getting tired of the millennial grays and all of that stuff? Do you see sort of a monumental shift, or is that just more hype than
do you hire interior designers for your buildings, or you do everything yourself?
No, we do it all ourselves. I would say that's mostly my line. Tom's more of the nuts and bolts in the field. I'm more of the design, the floor plans, the layouts. I manage the sales process, manage the agents to make sure that there's congruency between what's being built, what's being presented to the buyers, and then making sure that gets delivered. So I guess I'll weigh in on this. And, I've seen the trend shift to more warmer tones rather than the cool ones we've kind of been leaning towards over the past couple of years. My personal preference is that I think white is always, it's malleable. So I think all of us started in a very similar platform where like it was a moment in time and you can walk in those condos from that moment in time and know exactly when they were built. You see the cherry cabinets, you see the mosaic backsplash. You know, it's very easy to tell that era of construction.
Yeah, dark sun, floors, dark sunshine, floors, yellow paint.
Earth tones on walls. And, you know, we kind of jumped early to the monochromatic kind of cool tones and we got great feedback on that. And now, as we all know, it's kind of like widely spread across the market. So there's now a shift, and I've seen a lot of it to more warmer tones. My only problem with that is I think it's cyclical. And I think the white and the cool tones and the monochromatic palette is kind of timeless, because I think you can take a white shaker cabinet, it might be kind of boring, and an Arctic white countertop, right? Like all white, pretty generic. But I think you can swap out the countertop, put new cabinet hardware and put a new backsplash, and pretty quickly make that kitchen look new and funky and kind of fresh with the times. If you go with an espresso cabinet, or you go with a gray, or you go with a blue, it's a moment in time and there's not much you can do with it from there. You can certainly paint the cabinet. You know, that's always an option, but it's not ideal. And a lot of these cabinets, it's not as easy to paint as people think. That's kind of my perspective, is every time we try to do something overly bold or something that's kind of in trend with the time, the market doesn't really reward us. Oftentimes I think people are like, I like it, but you know, I really wanted, for example, like we don't do any subway tile backsplash. I can't tell you how many times people have come in and we've done a really cool backsplash and they'll be like, I would really just like to see a white subway tile backsplash. I'm like, it's not an apartment, you know, it's a condo. We're spending more money on the tile.
I've tried to move away from like the dark and moody. I think that people are spending a lot more time in their homes and they do want it to be sort of this relaxing, soothing environment. So trying to use more wood grains, natural stones, lighter, softer colors, even some pastels. I was doing some salmon, I'll call it, not pink tile in the primary bath. So, and I've gotten some good feedback on that. Whether or not that will stand up to time, I'm not sure, but I'd like to believe that these sort of natural elements that are occurring in your home are timeless.
It's probably also, you know, if you're doing spec building, right, you need to appeal to the widest masses, and people know they can swap those things out. So may not necessarily be a barrier. If you go real eclectic, or you go real specific, or even real trendy of the week, month, or year, it might make it more difficult. So I guess you can't please everybody, but that's what you're seeing in terms of things on your end. That's
Can I tell you what I'm tired of spending money on?
Let's hear it.
Luxury plumbing fixtures. I've always been kind of a geek about that, and really, like,
No one cares.
No one knows.
No one knows.
I walk them through. I'm like, these are all Brizo fixtures. You know,
what's Brizo?
Yeah, exactly.
I think you do that on like the multi-million-dollar product. That's where you
maybe.
Or if you have a spec book, like we looked at a few jobs where the architect had a pretty sizable book of design. Like if it's spec, then people are going to pay for it.
But I saw a spec home in Newton recently, and the broker, who I really respect, was promoting in capital letters, all Delta fixtures. It's like saying all Toyota cars. Like, it's an okay car. Delta's fine.
But I think people only know the big names. Yeah. So people know Kohler.
And Kohler's super luxury.
People know Delta. Waterworks. People know Moen. Like, they don't know these, like the Brizos
Waterworks.
And the, what?
Waterworks.
Yeah, and the Hans Grohe's and all these higher end fixtures that you can spend all this money on. They know, and they know Simmons. Like, they know the brands that they grew up with and that they've seen.
We've defaulted back to Simmons. So we had the same process as you. We were using all these design forward looks and a lot of Brizo. And, you know, it was like a Delta valve and a Brizo.
Mm-hmm.
So we were like, at least Simmons.
Yeah, I think Delta owns Brizo, right?
They do. That's Toyota Lexus.
Yeah.
But on Simmons, like, you know, if your cartridge goes, it's very easy to replace that yourself. Any plumber can do it. You can go to Home Depot and get the parts. You don't need a plumbing supply. It's very easy to fix.
Yeah.
I've had like Moen and Kohler's go wrong, and the cartridges, you're ordering parts, and if they're a couple years old, they stop making it. Simmons has done a very good job kind of streamlining the compatibility of their components.
Very plug and play.
Yeah. So blessing and a curse. Do I think that Simmons's design is that sexy? Not really, but it's clean.
They've gotten better.
They have substance.
Well, they have a higher end, certainly. Like, not what you see in the store every day. Like, you got to go source it.
You know, another epiphany I recently had was floating floors are not bad. I used to always insist on gluing down my floors. I'd pay a premium for it.
Hardwood, engineered, all types.
All types. I'd either glue down or I would nail down if we didn't have gypsum creep below it.
Yeah.
But man, you know, I get it if you're doing a renovation of a 1788 house and the floors are all wonky. But if you're building new construction, your substrate should be fairly level and good, and you can float them. And once you put furniture down, I really challenge you to walk around and tell me if they're floating or glued. And it's better for sound attenuation.
That's what we think too. It's decoupled.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah, we've been arguing that for a while, but there's no assembly.
It's hard to get a quantitative response and stuff like that. Hey, how many STC do I get if I float the floors?
Oh, gosh.
I promise you.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, if you talk to an acoustical engineer.
There you are.
We'll go offline,
But it's a good point because, you know, when you're under construction control or that sort of thing, you technically do need an approved assembly that's tested in a lab, and there's N million different variables, so they can't test them all. And so it may, in theory, you're like, this is literally the same thing. It's like, well, wasn't tested in a lab, so we can't certify.
Do you guys get sound complaints a lot at all?
knock on wood. No, it's, we generally spend the money on Gypcrete. Again, I'll let Tom kind of weigh into our standard assembly, but sound is not somewhere we really shy on. We go for like as noise dampened. We even put carpet in the hallway still, because it really does muffle the noise substantively.
Are you doing those hush frames? Like you did hush frame, right?
I use hush frame on every track.
And is that different than like RC on the walls? Is it a different application?
It's far superior. If you're going to use like a resilient channel or a grommeted clip, an RC1 clip with a rubber grommet, they're somewhat comparable. But if you're just going to go with a straight like clip, the metal clip without that grommeted rubber washer, that's not doing very much.
What about just RC directly to the studs?
Doing almost nothing.
Okay. Because we've been told it's different frequencies for that versus like making sure you have a tight air barrier. And I'm not getting specific into any one project. Mm-hmm. I'm just at the high level.
We could go on and on about sound attenuation. But yeah, anyway. That's one of those problems where you can't fix. If you get a phone call, then you're screwed.
Intangible again, where you feel like when we do pour Gypcrete, almost like you're stepping into a hotel. Like regardless of, you know, an assembly number, it feels quiet. You really feel like you've deadened noise in a way that matters.
That's what I like about townhouses, though, because you're not separating sound acoustically, between floors. It's all within a house. I'm much less sensitive if you hear your, you know, kid running above you.
Yeah.
If it's your neighbor.
Absolutely. And I think that lends to a good point that I don't care how good the sound attenuation is. If they have a 3-year-old who's riding a tricycle around the living room above you,
or bowling,
you're going to hear it.
No, there's no such thing as soundproof. There's only sound resistant.
Yeah. I had a tenant that it's an older house, but we had a tenant that was complaining about another one that moved in. And then when that person eventually moved out, because we kind of forced them to, we discovered a hammer that somebody was just banging on the table to piss off the person downstairs. Just two people don't get along, you know, and clearly they were messing with them.
Sound is so funny because different people can be sensitive to sound different ways. And also like we're kind of a victim of our own success because we've built the envelope so tight. So you used to get all this background noise. You'd get cars, you know, you'd hear the dishwasher. Dishwashers are silent.
So
the windows are triple pane. Now you hear a little murring and you're like, it's driving me nuts because there's nothing to wash it out.
Yeah, and now we're putting in mini splits, which are quiet too. You're not getting that gas fire furnace that kicks on with the return pull in the air and
all
no
the
white
points.
Noise.
You think we'll be like the electric cars where they forced them to make like white noise so you know the car's on, right? Like in the apartments, you have to have little speakers just giving out random.
I've gotten not complaints, but I've gotten questions about like why is the fan. We put in like the Panasonic whisper quiet fans where you can barely
people
hear.
Think they're running,
and they're like, why are they running all of the time? Why is it always on? I was like, you can hear that on in your bathroom?
Almost.
You're obsessing over that.
But we've had the opposite. They're like, I don't think the fan's working. It's like, no, it is. It's just really quiet.
Yeah.
Almost every building we've ever delivered, there's at least one buyer who's like, hey, as part of the things I want you to look at, the fan won't turn off.
Yeah.
You know? And you're like, all right, we'll try to explain that to you so you understand it.
Well, hey, we got about 5 minutes left. I didn't want to finish this episode without talking about Build Boston. Tom, it's been sort of a passion project of yours. Yeah, tell us about it. What are you up to?
It goes back to the fire-rated cans. Like when you're learning and like trying to grow in this business, I feel like you're always hunting for answers and they're pretty guarded. Like, you know, new people you hear, they're like, well, I got the certificate of occupancy checklist from ISD. And like whoever produces that document, if you're going to follow it, you're going to crash into a wall. And it seems like there's got to be a better way. It's obviously informal, so it's just a platform to try and centralize some of that knowledge and resources so that someone else out there who might be a peer might have a better way of doing it than you, or one or the both of you has a better way of doing it than someone who's new. And it's just a way to share and make building in Boston a little more predictable and a little less risky. And I feel like it should have always existed.
Yeah.
But when you are looking for that fire-rated can answer, it's only as good as who you can call. You got to ask someone who has experience, like, hey, not that you should get away with this, but can I get away with this? Mm-hmm. Or other people doing this? Like, am I going to get called? Who's going to call me out? Like, is this what the city's doing?
Plenty of areas in the code that have
so many gray areas that can be overcome.
But so it's a networking group. If folks wanted to get involved or were interested, it's primarily for builders. Reach out to you, Tom.
Yeah, Build Boston on Instagram. And I'd love to talk to them.
Cool, man. And JD, how can folks find Elevated Boston if they're looking for, brokerage services, new development product, et cetera?
Yeah. So on Instagram, we're Elevated Boston. Our development company is the Elevated Companies on Instagram. And then me personally, I'm elevated.jd on Instagram. So,
and I've got Elevated Construction Co. We got them all covered.
Nice. Yeah. Awesome, guys. Well, this is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for having us. And congratulations to you guys. Both Tom and I listen to your podcast, and you guys are doing a great job.
Yeah. Awesome content.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Almost to 100.
Yeah.
Getting there.
On the road.
Thanks to you guys for listening, rating, reviewing, subscribing, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Cheers.